I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the relationship between advocacy and activism, and the personal and the political. It seems that both advocacy and activism and the personal and the political are completely intertwined for you.
I think you're right. All these things are intertwined, but in many ways they also point to the fact that in Pakistan now, there is a lot of low-lying fruit. Anyone who goes out with, you don't need to have a brilliant idea, but just an idea. Anyone who goes out with just an idea and a little bit of dedication to it is going to go a long way in establishing and articulating their voice. And that's what activism and advocacy has been. I mean, I've been an advocate because I am. I mean, I get engaged by civil society organizations to conduct cases. That's my advocacy. I have activism because many times I feel that courts of law are insufficient in themselves to answer problems. You need to create an awareness amongst people of the meaning of the issues that you're fighting for. And that's activism for me. It's to go out and to explain the dimensions of a debate to people and to arm them with an opinion on it. You know, and then I'll be their lawyer as well. I consider myself first and foremost a lawyer. It's what my training is, it's what I do. I wake up in the morning, I go to a law firm. I make rich people richer. I appear to be particularly good at it. But I mean, I keep on telling people that even a monkey can do banking law. It's not very complicated stuff. So over the last couple of years, I have, through a variety of accidents, intention, found myself working on environmental issues, conservation issues, city issues, water, energy. And just what's been very interesting is that although I consider myself a lawyer, I really feel that I'm participating in Pakistani culture as it's growing, as it lives right now.
But, I mean, you also had, if I understand correctly, as a lawyer, you also interned with Asma Jahangir.
My first legal experience was with Asma.
Right. And so you're not just a lawyer. You're also a lawyer that, in a way, if I understand correctly, really believes in the importance of advocating and working as an activist for a variety of social issues.
Well, that's the reason why I became a lawyer, was with Asma. Mm-hmm. Asma, I remember, took me to the Lahore's criminal courts. Uh-huh. And it was the first time someone like myself, with my background, very protected, had ever seen the real world and had ever seen people in chains. And these were not people who, you know, I saw normally, socially, at a club or whatever golf game that I was playing. These are very poor people shackled together for, and in a process which they don't appear to understand. It just seemed very unfair. And it was very clear to me that, yeah, well, this is something I think I could work here and try and make a difference. But whether that's actually wound up happening, I don't know whether that actually has wound up happening. I do remember very clearly that that was the reason why I wanted to become a lawyer.
And what were some of the issues, what were some of the kind of, I know that she was working on kind of at the forefront of blasphemy and child labor and women's rights and human rights issues. Were those also issues that you were working on with her?
Well, yeah, I mean, we were growing up in Pakistan, and these were issues that were in the press, in the papers. This was stuff that people were writing about. Asma was in the HRCP, the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. It was a well-respected civil society organization. It was highlighting, you know, the brutalities against minorities, against women, and seemed to be doing the right thing. So, I mean, if there was an intellectual umbrella that I grew up on, it was very much the umbrella that these sorts of organizations provided. Mm-hmm.
So one of the reasons I brought up Jahangir to begin with was because, like her and like her practice, your practice straddles so many different topics and sectors and fields and issues, ranging from questions of public infrastructure and the politics of mobility, to equitable urban planning approaches, to environmental issues and social justice. So I was wondering if, do you feel that you have a specialty? Do you feel like your practice addresses a particular issue, or do you feel that in a way that heterogeneity is very much what you believe in as a lawyer, as a legal activist, advocate?
I know which side of the line I'm standing on, but there's I don't think the work that Asma was doing at the time, I remember working with her, but not completely satisfied with the types of issues that human rights were addressing, or the Human Rights Commission was addressing. And that had a lot to do with the sort of intellectual traditions of the that generated the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. These were traditions that, reacted to military government. They reacted to the oppression of women. And as a result, the HRCP in its tactics and in its strategy addressed those issues more directly than it did others. And in many ways, the rhetoric that was generated from the HRCP and the subsequent rhetoric of civil society itself has been in many ways limited by the dimensions that it set itself at its inception. So issues like religious persecution, female equality, child rights were always at the forefront. But issues, and of course physical violence, were always at the forefront. But I thought other systemic issues like proprietary rights were not properly addressed, for example. And proprietary rights, if you don't have good property rights, I mean, there's no end of problems. It's like saying if 2 plus 2 equals 5, then 4 plus 4 equals whatever the hell you want. So if you don't have a good property regime, anything is there. So it was weird that the HRCP, to me, wasn't addressing these sorts of issues. And I think when I was very lucky, I had the opportunity of studying in England, studying law in England. And when I came back to Pakistan, found an interest in trying to interpret proprietary issues using the law as a means. And that brought me to the study of cities first, because, you know, property transactions, then the larger question of what framework the property transactions work in, two questions of how do you zone areas, two larger questions like urban planning and master planning, then became the focus of more study. And these were different from the types of things that ASMA and the HRCP and civil society have been fighting, but not to say that I'm the first and only person to be doing this. There are other articulations of the same problems, because the articulation comes because the problems of urban issues are shared by big cities and developing countries around the world. It's just a question of people coalescing together enough and for the issues to come to the fore enough to be able to generate a framework of discussion. And so, I mean, if I could look back, I think I've been successful in generating a bit of a framework of discussion, but by no means am I the only one to do so. And in answer to your question, yes, it is different from what Jahangir and HRCP have been doing so far.
I mean, is it different in part, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're also saying is that the problems that were being diagnosed by the HRC, for instance, weren't addressing the underlying structural issues that were the cause of that? Are you trying to say that the structural problems weren't being addressed fundamentally?
No, I said that, you're right, that's exactly what I said. But if you asked anyone in HRCP, they would turn around and say, Rafe, physical violence, religious freedom, women's rights are structural issues. And you're talking about. I just felt that the type of contribution I could have made was not found within the work that was at that time being done by civil society, the civil society that I'd grown up with. And you know, this has led to a larger, there are other people who've also critiqued the civil society movement in Pakistan and have said that it has been, it was limited by its vision at the time and history. And that is true, These guys sat down basically against Zia-ul Haq in 1980. Zia-ul Haq had taken over and executed a civilian government, and he'd executed an elected prime minister and had immediately thereafter started unrolling a whole bunch of legislation that, to use a phrase, Islamicized Pakistan. And so HRCP grew out of that. And it's interesting, for one of the examples given by this filmmaker, Sabiha Sumar, she's a Pakistani filmmaker, was that there was a conscious decision made by the people participating in the early movements, political movements against Zia, not to use religion as a means or as one of the tools in their rhetoric to combat the rollout of Islamization. Because at the time, the religious parties in Pakistan, they were in minority, they weren't organized, and it seemed sick to speak a language that would give them an opportunity to step onto a platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so the critiques of civil society against the rollout of Islamization were very secular in nature. They were, for instance, that the laws regarding evidence of women in courts in Pakistan are discriminatory towards women. You know, rather than examining the Quranic verse which prescribes this, mm-hmm. and looking at the interpretation it's gotten over history, they chose to take a secular language to the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And Subiha says, well, it was a conscious decision made at the time because no one had the benefit of hindsight. No one knew that through the 1980s, with the Afghan war, with Saudi money coming to Pakistan, with the Iran revolution and the growth of Shiaism in Pakistan, that the religious parties in Pakistan would grow and would inevitably get a political platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so what wound up happening is, still now, civil society speaks a secular language when it should be speaking, well, some people believe it should be speaking a more dynamic language, including religion,
mm-hmm.
so that it can speak to people. You know, and so the activism has also revealed a shortcoming in civil society, the articulation of issues. And one of the things I'd like to do is certainly try and be a medium between the language spoken and the rhetoric of civil society as it exists now, and see if we can't bring religion into it in a sort of more dynamic way. So that we can, I mean, we're smarter, we're better organized. Surely we can fight a debate and win a debate about whether a governor of a province should be shot in the back for defending a Christian woman, for giving a Muslim woman a glass of water. I mean, surely we are smarter than this.
Could you talk a bit more about the work that you're doing through the judiciary? I know the judiciary is something that in kind of a piece that you wrote for Newsline magazine, you explained was in tatters, the judiciary, but also the judicial movement was in tatters. So what is some of the work that you're doing through legal advocacy that could kind of help me understand on a practical level how...
Oh, God. I mean, it's so tedious in my life. My comment about the judicial movement at the time, and this is in 2007,
mm-hmm.
Has been subsumed by by events afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
The Chief Justice was restored, the judiciary and the judicial movement appears to have won.
Mm-hmm.
So I stand corrected, but certainly history has a different way of looking at what I said back then.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm doing in court right now, over the last couple of years, what I've been doing is we've been taking what we consider to be winnable environmental and urban planning cases through the system of the Pakistani judiciary. For urban and environmental issues, we have a dispute resolution process that's centered around an environmental tribunal that sits here in Lahore. And so every now and then, when there is an issue that we feel doesn't require too much debate. We don't want to take... No one wants to put a huge amount of effort into something that's questionable.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take something to court that you want to win,
mm-hmm.
or you can win. So we take winnable propositions to court and we feed them through the system, because I believe that doing so allows the system to move, you know, and it gets the cobwebs out of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a system that exists. There's a dispute resolution process. Here's a winnable issue. It's complicated, but it's winnable. We want to take it through the process so it becomes a precedent, so that years from now, people can learn from it. Because I don't know if you've heard, legal activism in Pakistan is a euphemism for the High Court and the Supreme Court of Pakistan to take judicial activism into their own hands,
mm-hmm.
and to summon for cases to resolve themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes if there's an issue that appears that the Supreme Court or to the Lahore High Court has a question of fundamental rights that affects a large population of people, they can call the case to themselves and adjudicate it, but not in a sort of adversarial manner, in a different procedure, in a sort of conciliatory way to try and bring substantive justice. But what winds up happening when you take a case to the Supreme Court, and there are many instances of where this has happened, a good one is a case a couple of years ago filed by the WWF Pakistan, challenging the construction of a residential housing area in a designated forest in near Murray. It was called the New Murray Project. And this was a case that was taken up suo motu by the Supreme Court of Pakistan. You know, the government of Punjab hired the best lawyers it could. WWF had excellent lawyers on its side, and the matter revolved around the legal issue of whether you could do something like that or not. But in many ways, the adjudicatory process of the tribunal was bypassed for a much more high-profile adjudicatory process. It wasn't the legal process. It was the Supreme Court taking sua motu notice of a case. And I felt and I saw that the Environment Protection Agency and the tribunal atrophied because of the action of the Supreme Court. Because normally this was something that they would have resolved themselves, and they would have had all this expertise brought to them, and it would have increased their capacity. Mm-hmm. But instead, what wound up happening is that the Supreme Court took notice and then would direct that officials from the Environment Protection Agency and elsewhere come and explain their positions. Mm-hmm. And for a bureaucrat in Pakistan, I mean, this is as close to a death sentence as you're handing them out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you terrorize the bureaucrats in charge. They refuse to work. They say, look, the Supreme Court's taken sua motu. They're the people to decide the issue. We're not going to do anything unless there's an order that tells us to do things. And as a result, the adjudicatory process provided for the tribunal itself and the Environment Protection Agency, they don't grow mm-hmm. because of the activism being done on the part of the Supreme Court or by the High Court. Mm. So what we've been doing over the last couple of years is we've been taking winnable cases and we've been putting them through the process mm-hmm. so that we can generate precedent.
So you act... So are you like a catalyst in a way? Like, you're not obstructionist in the sense that you're only taking on cases that you think are winnable. But in a way, you're trying to initiate a process. Is that how you describe your practice, in a way?
No, it's just winnable cases. Let's put them through the system. Uh-huh. And, you know, we'll have a precedent, uh-huh. and then we'll use the precedent later on. Really, right. that's what right. that level of activism is. But, I mean, in between, there have been instances where issues come up that are not amenable to the long delays mm-hmm. of environment tribunals. These are issues that need to be taken up and resolved by a much more powerful adjudicatory body like the High Court and the Supreme Court. So I have also been involved in litigation over the last couple of years on urban issues and urban development issues where we've gone directly to the High Court. Mm-hmm.
But you also seem, I mean, perhaps I'm only learning about your practice now, but it seemed that you also have insisted, despite the cynicism that one may have towards the judicial system or the legal system in Pakistan, it seems that you've also insisted on the letter of the law often, particularly when it comes to environmental issues. You've kind of...
I didn't make the law. They made it. And uh-huh. what we're trying to do is just make sure that the law is sensible. The law is not stupid. It's a good law. And all we're asking is that it be followed. Mm-hmm. The law says that for big projects that might cause an adverse environment effect, you have an environment impact assessment that's conducted. You have a public hearing on the assessment. And then the Environment Protection Agency will either approve or deny permission for the project based on the environment assessment. Right. I mean, it's a law. I didn't make it. It was a legislation right. that was passed by the government 10 years ago.
But could you talk... Yeah. But I mean, are you talking here about like the Kalma Chowk project? Or,
yeah. Because... What people tend to forget in this is that I'm not opposing development. Mm-hmm. What I'm insisting on is the public hearing on the EIA, mm-hmm. which is quite dynamic. The public hearing of the EIA has come into our law. The requirement has come into our law.
The environment EIA, you mean environmental impact assessment?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It has been introduced in our law as a result of, if I'm not mistaken, it's the Rio Declaration. Mm-hmm. The Rio Declaration talks about the precautionary principle. It talks about involving people in the development process. It talks about a dispute resolution mechanism. And that's exactly what we have. We have a system where every time a big project is to be decided, mm-hmm. the precautionary principle kicks in and you do an assessment of the project. Mm-hmm. We have public participation in our law because the public is invited to make comments on the environment impact assessment. And we have a judicial mechanism in the environment tribunal if we don't like the result of what happened. And actually, if you think about it, having people comment on the environment impact assessment is a great way of involving them in the development that they will be experiencing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite a dynamic. It's a very democratic law. And I'm very impressed by it. I wish more people saw what I saw in it mm-hmm. and saw the sort of democratic potential of it.
Because what you see, I mean, and here I'm referencing that interview you did for the Express Tribune. But what I hear and what you're saying is that the law enables an opportunity to be had for introducing equity and democracy into urban planning.
That's a bit of rhetoric. It's a bit of polish. It's equity and it brings democracy in because it allows people to see things. I mean, normally development projects in third world countries, well, I don't know, man, around the world, Tammany Hall was an example of how urban issues were resolved by mafias, and that took 100 years, it took 50 years to fix. And we're experiencing exactly the same thing in developing countries, and a lot of times the importance of what's going on is lost by the glamour of the project that's being introduced. I mean, people are very impressed by roads. Roads in Pakistan are a symbol of development. They bring mobility and accessibility to markets. They're a sign of prosperity. All sorts of things can be done with roads. So people are deeply impressed by them, but they don't understand the deeper developmental trade-offs that road infrastructure can have.
And those are, for instance, that 40% walk to work, but there's no sidewalks, things like this?
Yeah, 40%. Yeah.
Was the politics of it seems like the politics of mobility and the basic right to move freely in the city, it seems like that's become such an important issue for you and such a recurrent kind of aspect of the work that you're doing. Has it always been that way? Is that kind of something you've arrived at?
I've been very deeply influenced by people like Enrique Penalosa in Bogota. He used to be the mayor of Bogota in the 1990s. And is famous for setting out the circulutas, the cycle system in Bogota, and introducing the transmillennial bus system. And basically what he did is he connected all the slums in Bogota. I mean, the income disparity in Bogota is the highest in Central America. And he connected all the slums in the poor areas with a cycle system. He connected them to schools and to libraries that he built. And in his 3-year tenure, he built 12 libraries because he wanted kids who couldn't afford to go to malls, shopping malls, or to restaurants to be able to go to these things that he called temples of knowledge, which I thought was awesome, a great idea. And from things like that and from cycling, it's pretty clear that the right to mobility is something that has not yet been articulated strongly enough. And I'd be very, very happy if I could get the court in Lahore here on the Kalma Chowk issue to deliberate upon or at least mention the right of mobility. I mean, this is how stuff gets into law. And who knows, 30 years from now, it could be useful. But essentially, the right of mobility is an idea which says that everyone has a God-given, from the moment you're born, inherent right to move from point A to point B. But that inherent within this right itself should be a bunch of options available. So when I exercise my right to move from A to B, I should not be restricted in how I do so. I should be able to walk, use a cycle, use a motorcycle, a car, a taxi, ride a bus, use an underground system, ride an escalator, use a cycle, use an elevator. All sorts of options appear before, or should appear before me when I exercise this right. And yet what we see happening in places like Pakistan and all over the world is urban development which increasingly puts a premium on automobile use, and as a result excludes the other options that are available. When you're in Lahore, there are less than 500 buses in a city of 8 to 10 million people. Well, it's ludicrous. People talk about, and it affects people's opinions on public transport, because when you talk to people about public transport, they say, well, we hate public transport, it's shameful. And you go, well, yeah, but what we have on the streets here is not public transport, it's extortion. Public transport would be 20,000 buses. It would be cheap and available mobility to everybody. But when you don't have mobility, when you restrict the choices that are available to people, you wind up doing things like making it very difficult and uncomfortable for women to move around. You make it next to impossible for the elderly or for children or for the handicapped to move around. And you restrict them from the legitimate economic and social opportunities that they should have in a city. So, and you know what I find?
So for you, it's not just an issue of having a basic opportunity to have access to public infrastructure. It's also that it ultimately segregates populations in a way. The lack of public infrastructure segregates. It's not just a matter of that it restricts movement.
It's actually both things, but I just want to continue on this right to mobility.
Sure, sure.
Because one of the interesting things, Enrique Penalosa came to Pakistan a couple of years ago, and I was very lucky because I was part of that process. And I remember telling him that my grandmother and her sisters used to cycle to college when they were in Rawalpindi in the 1940s. But that, you know, just 60 or 70 years later, we've developed a social attitude that seems to exclude women in Pakistan from public spaces. Mm-hmm. And it's a remarkably short period of time for social attitudes to have changed so completely. So I was wondering what sort of factors would be a catalyst. And he answered with speed that sort of disarmed me. He said, well, it's the car. It's the car that causes these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it's true. I mean, the automobile is very destructive. And it winds up reinforcing social values that may or may not be there. Let me rephrase this. There's another person I've learned a lot from over the course of years, Nadeem Al-Haq. He's an economist and has worked with the IMF for many years and comes in and out of Pakistan, is always a sparring partner. And he has this example. He talks about how, he talks about this mobility. He links mobility with urban planning and zoning in a way. And he talks about this idea of privacy. He says, you know, what's happened in Pakistan, the way we have our houses, is that privacy has become very cheap. If you can commodify privacy, it's become very cheap and available to people. Mm-hmm. And as a result, and things reinforce the cheapness. I mean, we have houses with walls, you know, we can segregate our women. And maybe the free and cheap availability of privacy contributes to an attitude which believes that privacy is the norm. Mm-hmm. Whereas privacy is actually quite expensive in any other high-density urban area like Tokyo or London or New York. Mm-hmm. The type of privacy we enjoy in Pakistan is actually quite costly. Mm-hmm. But the trade-off is social and social participation that changes social attitudes. You know, if a guy comes home at 10 o'clock at night and has to go up to his apartment, 7 floors, and finds that he doesn't have milk, he might be more likely to send his daughter down to get some milk than go down himself. And so things like privacy and things like the availability of mobility may have or may be a potential means by way you can affect social attitudes again. So that it's possible for women to come back into the public space in places like Pakistan. You know, if you have great public transport, if you have the right to mobility, if privacy is something that is not seen as so readily available that it seems to be the norm, then maybe social attitudes can change again. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of confident about these sorts of things. I think 60 years in the growth of social attitudes is nothing. And if it took 60 years for society to, you know, like my grandmother 60 years ago could ride a cycle, and now it's women don't ride cycles in Pakistan.
Right,
fine, fair enough. Give me another 60 years and I can turn that around.
I want to stay on this topic, at least abstractly. I've always thought of you as being kind of a critical voice, but one that's positioned from the outside. But clearly you've always been working in a number of ways and on a number of fronts, whether on planning commissions, or now as chairman of LESCO, the Lahore Electricity Supply Company. So in a certain sense, you're really working from within, positioned from within. Would you say that you're becoming a powerful insider? How do you negotiate these, at least maybe they're traditional ways of thinking, but how do you negotiate?
In many ways, it's evidence of how effective the system here in Pakistan is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was vocal, I had a critical voice, I have a critical voice. Some people appreciated it. And for whatever value, you know, they've chosen me for a particular job. Mm-hmm. I think that speaks of how a process should work. Mm-hmm. You know, you have someone who works, who has an opinion. He passes through whatever tests they may be and then is given a position. But does this change one's attitude? I hope not. Mm-hmm. I hope now, not as an outsider. When you ask me about LESCO, for example, it's been about a month since I was elected. Mm-hmm. So I'm yet to decide. I'm yet to learn about how this thing is going to work. Mm-hmm. But I certainly don't consider myself an outsider. I sort of consider myself as having an opportunity at LESCO, for example, of bringing in a new dimension to the debate. And this removes the aspect of whether I'm inside or outside. I mean, LESCO is a good example. LESCO is the Lahore Electricity Supply Company. We buy electricity from the grid and we supply it to the people of 5 districts in and around Lahore. There are shitloads of electricity shortages in Pakistan, right? And some of them have to do with the inefficiencies that the system that the LESCO provides for has inherent in it. I mean, some of our grid systems are 40 years old. But the main source of energy problems in Pakistan is the fact that there's not enough electricity that's being produced for the people of Pakistan. I mean, I it's like, you know, I get 100 potatoes to sell. I don't have 150 potatoes. If I had 150 potatoes, I'd sell them. But I think now that I have a scarce resource like electricity, and we're distributing it to so many people, I think there is an opportunity to expand how the debate relating to energy is spoken about in Pakistan. So far, the debate on energy talks about energy production and what government policies need to be in place so that we have more hydroelectricity or more solar electricity or more electricity for the system. Mm-hmm. In the distribution business that LESCO is in, when we talk about what LESCO can do, LESCO buys electricity and supplies it. It can improve its efficiency by reducing the line losses in its transmission grid. And it can improve its bill collecting by making sure there's no corruption and making sure defaulters pay. But I don't think that that's the limit to debate. I think there's a very important aspect that's forgotten. We're a developing country, and there's a huge, huge link between development and energy. Everyone knows this. You know, you electrify a village, you change people's lives. You provide at least enough electricity for them to power their mobile phones, and you give them, you know, connectability that they've never had before. It's, all the development indicators are very much, they depend on energy. And you can, I'm very interested in seeing if I can generate a new face of the debate on energy so that we talk about energy and development and use that as a means to talk about conservation. So I'm not really as an outsider or an insider. I've been given the keys of something, you know, careful what you wish for. Uh-huh. I've been given the keys of something and told that I'm allowed to drive it, but I have to pay for the petrol myself.
But what I'm hearing from you is that it's not that you kind of advocated for the position of chairman with a platform. It's that your process, your methodology, your practice is that now that you're in this position, you'll kind of in a measured or a gradual way arrive at kind of a position. Is that, am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah. But this was not something I planned. This was not something that a couple of weeks ago was anywhere on my horizon. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now I have this responsibility. And the best thing to do, I think, is, I mean, of course, your line efficiencies, your line losses, and your collections are important. But I think the people of Lahore and the area of Lahore that LESCO supplies electricity to can benefit from new debates. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a company, but I think companies don't necessarily just have to work for profit. Mm-hmm. I think a company that sells electricity especially has to keep development in mind. Mm-hmm. And these are things that I've grown up believing and knowing. So now that I have this responsibility, I think in discharge of it would be very much to put these debates out and make sure that they last longer than I.
Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, okay, sorry. And in a certain sense, you're also arguing for the importance of a legal business, if I'm quoting, again, that previous kind of newsline comment. But the idea of kind of not just a kind of rebuilding a judiciary system, but also constructing like a legal business infrastructure is something that you, I guess, would believe strongly in.
I know making money as a lawyer is very, very tough. Uh-huh. I need to find out how I can monetize what I do. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And like I said, I make rich people richer. My day job is I'm a commercial lawyer. Uh-huh. I answer all sorts of commercial questions every single day. Uh-huh. It's not very familiar, satisfying. And most of the stuff that I do, activism-wise, is actually outside office hours. Because I have a terrible boss. And this is also, you know, one of the burdens that activists have to carry around here. Yeah. You've got to keep your day job.
And, I mean, I know that you began identifying, and you identify in every sense as a lawyer. But as I hear you talk, about the importance of learning from, for instance, Latin America and South America and what's been happening there. And as I hear you speaking about kind of urban planning, I almost hear in your voice and in your discourse the language of a community advocate or kind of a community planner. And I also know that you're serving in a number of capacities and you're advocating in a number of capacities for what I would think of as causes that are fundamentally kind of associated with urban planning, architecture of a different sort, of a community-oriented sort, socially-oriented sort. So, I mean, could you talk a bit about how you've ended up there and situated in this way disciplinarily? Why these particular kind of disciplinary perspectives of community planning, of architecture, of urban planning have become so important?
I have no experience, I have no background, I have no qualification to talk about cities, except that I live in one, and just by virtue of that, I'm an expert on cities, is the sort of attitude I take to this entire debate. Cities happened because, like I said, I was teaching property law, and one thing sort of led to another, and sort of started asking questions about why things happen in a city a particular way, and then learning that, you know, I'm not the first person to ask these questions, that urban development, I mean, there have been planned cities through civilizations, you know, through thousands of years. This is not new stuff. But was able then, I saw very clearly at the time, the opportunity to articulate a debate that no one else was really talking about in Pakistan. I when people ask me, I sort of laughingly tell them that here in Pakistan, everyone's an expert either of medicine, of constitutional law, or of women's rights. And I mean, at least in the media, you get that impression. So I thought that there might be an opportunity for someone who was an expert on environmental and urban issues, because, I mean, after all, I live in a city and I have to breathe the bloody air over here. So that's where I sort of took my departure point, that I could try and be an expert on these issues as well. And wound up happening a couple of years ago is I started, because I felt that there was this little gap in the media when it came to articulating certain issues, I started writing a column in one of the newspapers, which basically was an exercise in answering the questions I had in my own mind about what was happening in my city from a property law perspective, from a growth perspective. And over the course of, I think, 4 or 5 years, I must have written hundreds, if not thousands, of articles every single week. And then twice a week, I was writing for 2 newspapers. Was an opportunity to create a debate on cities, right or wrong, you know, right or wrong. Talk about urban planning, talk about energy conservation, talk about climate change, right or wrong, because I'm not an expert. I read stuff, I do it in my spare time, I write it down in an article and I put it out to the public for a debate, and in the hope that it would generate something. So that's how I got into cities. Someone must have read what I wrote and liked it and have asked me to help on a couple of in a couple of areas. And most recently, we were working towards forming a urban policy for the government of Pakistan, which sounds grand, but actually is terribly impractical, because the federal government should have nothing to do with what a city does. You know, I mean, if you think about it practically, the federal government should be concerned about war, it should be concerned about currency, it should be concerned about all sorts of other sort of federal issues, not about cities itself. But the thing about Pakistan is that nearly 80% of the GDP of the country is generated in its urban areas, which constitute less than 3% of its land mass. I was part of a process where the federal government was trying to make a policy on sort of urban development. And there are various justifications why there should be. And the clear justification is the economic efficiency angle of it. So using that as an excuse, the Planning Commission, which is part of the federal body of Pakistan, put together this task force. But really the principles that we worked off of, and I had the opportunity to work under the chairmanship of Arif Hassan, who's the urban planning guru of Pakistan and internationally as well. And I had a chance to work with him, and what basically we articulated was a fairly straightforward, I mean, again, not complicated vision for cities, and you won't find any dissimilar voices about cities elsewhere. Essentially, that cities, in order to be efficient, need to have high densities. You know, you don't get culture, you don't get interaction amongst people, you don't get that thing that makes cities dynamic unless you have a certain critical mass of people who meet and greet and interact with each other. And that only happens with high density. And this goes back to what I was talking about in terms of privacy. You can't have interaction amongst people if you seclude them away or if you keep them in private. And I, for one, really believe that high density cities may be a means of even challenging social norms like female segregation in Muslim cultures. So really, we thought, number one, you need to have high density. Number two, in order for cities to be effective, is you've got to provide mobility. You've got to provide public transport. And here, you know, mobility is not seen as something that is path-dependent on infrastructure as a solution, but that mobility should be seen as a fundamental right to get from A to B. Mm-hmm. And if we can change the articulation of the debate, maybe we might get somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were basically the two things we were going to do. And that's the major outlay of the policy was just that. And that really is one's thinking on cities. Mm-hmm. You want to have an effective city. You want to have a city that gives people an equal opportunity to participate in its development. Give them the opportunity to live in a city that doesn't segregate them amongst class lines or any other sorts of ways. And you give them the ability to get around. And then you let human beings do what they do beautifully, and that is create civilization.
So I want to kind of press you on this. I know we've already talked about this a bit, but so what methodologies do you then employ? On the one hand, you're a member of a variety of commissions, working from the top, I suppose, you could say. On the other hand, you were leading, for instance, in the case of the Kalmuk-Chuk project, you were leading a grassroots kind of campaign, it seems, to try to kind of enact a transformation in how an intersection was going to be developed or how traffic and congestion were going to be addressed. Like, so do you feel like you have a tactic, a strategy, or do you feel like from all angles you just advocate for change?
Well, a couple of years ago I thought I was going to die because there was too much going on. Mm-hmm. But there is a bit of a method to the madness that sort of I've set out. And I mean, really, my practice now focuses on three things. It focuses on cities, it focuses on energy, and it focuses on water. And these are the three areas that I work inside. And there are different techniques, there are different sets of people that I speak to, there are different interactions that I have in each of these three areas. So, for example, with cities, I've had the opportunity to be a grassroots activist, and I've worked with the federal government. With energy, I've had the opportunity to work with LESCO. And with water, I'm working entirely academically without any interaction with government. And within each one of these modes, or within each one of these three areas, the modes of activity change. So when I'm being an activist, the things that I use are the media, because I know that one person, if he gets on television, can be broadcast to so many thousands of people. It's much more effective than writing an academic paper. I know that if I am talking about energy, I speak to a different set of stakeholders, so there's a different mechanism that's used when I'm talking about energy. And likewise with water, when I'm talking academics, then it's purely paper-based, presentation-based stuff that we're doing.
And do these three different approaches or methodologies, do they kind of, do they in a way influence each other, or do they stimulate or catalyze each other? Or they're just autonomous in a sense?
I think cities and energy there's synergies between the two. Uh-huh. But the study of water, which has been the most recent, has been the most interesting because it is at a pace that is different from how we think about cities and the solutions that we have for energy. Water, when you study water, the perspective is entirely changed. You have to think in terms of thousands of years and in terms of, you know, settled agricultural civilizations and how they, you know, the mechanisms of these things. So, yeah, there is differences. I'm only beginning to learn them. But the main difference really is studying water and not studying water.
And perhaps one more question. I know that, I mean, you left out art and culture, but I know that art and culture have played a large role in your practice. It's very much part of the community that perhaps you've also been part of in Lahore. Could you talk about, for instance, the project with David Aylesworth in the Gandanalas and kind of almost a situationist, if I understand correctly, kind of cartographic.
No, I'm going to talk about David and the work we did with these water towers,
sure,
which was both insidious and brilliant from an activist point of view. There are these water towers in the Lahore cantonment, there are three of them, that must have been built about 140, 150 years ago by the British when they set up their cantonment, which is where they kept their regiments, their troops, in the 1860s. And it must have been used, these water tanks, to collect water so that the people of the area would have stuff for sort of, you know, their personal use, and maybe also to irrigate some land and to provide the greenery that is so associated with that development now. And it's been 150 years. The area around the water tanks has become decrepit. It's become completely, it's in the middle of town, so it's very high-priced real estate. It's owned by the military, and the military are seeking to make a little bit of money and also to provide housing for retired military officials by knocking down or raising the entire area surrounding the water tanks, and then, you know, making houses and shops and selling those. So David pointed out, quite rightly, that the masonry for these water towers was unique. It was ancient. It was very, very sophisticated. It was an example of masonry in India that had otherwise not been used. You know, the same sort of techniques that were being used in North England at the time. And this was pretty interesting. But we didn't think that it would... You see, if this was stuff that no one had ever heard about. These water tanks, for all practical purposes, were normal Lahori going down the street. It's just another water tank. You know, and if someone wants to knock it down to build a house, so be it. But David came up with this sort of interesting argument that, hold on, these things are important for this variety of reasons. So we wrote a couple of newspaper articles, and, you know, since then have been David especially has been speaking to people. But those articles essentially created a narrative for these water towers that gave them importance and resonance today. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have a narrative that supports built architecture, there is no way any activism is going to save it from destruction. Mm-hmm. And this is what I learned, that if you want to save stuff that's being destroyed in the name of development, there better be a damn good reason to do so. There better be a narrative to do so. And I think creating a narrative sometimes is an insidious tool. It worked in this particular case because those towers still stand, the watchtowers still stand. But it's an interesting way in which conservation takes place within culture. You know, you've got to have a narrative, an understanding between and amongst people of the importance of things before you can try and fight for them legally or through activism.